1 Samuel chapter 8. I've reached a new season in life. You can't tell, but these are the first pair of contacts that I have that are bifocal. And with how bad my eyes are, the doctor cannot believe that my close-up has been so good all these years, because my long, you know, seeing far away is absolutely terrible, and double digits in both eyes. But I'm cheap. So this one was feeling bad, so I took it out and put a regular one in. So I almost can't see this. So we're going to try to get through it, all right? 1 Samuel chapter 8. It goes like this. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them, according to all the deeds that they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands, commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements for war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain, of your vineyards, and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." And when Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey their voice and make them a king." Samuel then said to the men of Israel, "Go every man to his city." This is the word of God. So, up to this point, bringing in just a little bit of last week, Samuel has led Israel in a great act of repentance. That was chapter 7. It was a good chapter. Israel, heard Samuel say these words, "Direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines." And the people of Israel listened. They threw away their idols. They chose to turn their whole heart to the Lord and serve him. And we are now in chapter 8. And boy, oh boy, if this doesn't ring so clearly in our ears, because it's us pretty much every day of our lives. Israel listens to Samuel and rids themselves of all of these detestable things. And yet, as a little bit of time passes, we see right again they fall into struggling with trusting God. In this specific story, Israel would rather trust in what they can see, in what they can touch, in what they can control, rather than in God. And so I want us to witness this morning how Israel struggled to trust God through this story and to see if it doesn't really directly apply to our lives. And the way I want to do it is go back to the verse that we looked at in preparing our hearts, and I want to reverse the verse and use it, so to speak, as an instructional verse in a negative way, because I think that's what Israel did, and try to learn from it. Our premise this morning is do not trust in the Lord with all your heart. And lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, do not acknowledge him. And I had trouble with this last part. I guess, and you won't have straight paths. Your roads will be crooked. I would think they'd be way more than that. They'll probably look like Pennsylvania's roads and just have potholes everywhere so that you can't really even drive on them. So let me just, so we're on the same page as we look at this, right before I get into this idea of not trusting in the Lord, we all understand this word trust, right? What does the word trust mean? In a very literal sense, it means to lean on, like a cane or crutches. I would venture to say, and I know that most of you have done this over and over again, and that's why you did not need to apply any kind of test today, but I do see some visitors in the congregation today, and I actually noticed that you did not apply a test either when you chose to sit down on the pew this morning. You immediately trusted that it was going to hold you. Could you imagine how long it would take if you never trusted a seat that you sat in and you had to test it every time before you sat down? That's literally what trust means. It means to lean on. Figuratively, we have all kinds of ideas. We rely on. There's confidence in. The idea of waiting on, even, is trust. With trust, there's an idea of security, right? The idea of following. You don't follow something you don't trust. And I think this is important, and we'll look at this in just a second, but trust is a necessity because we are dependent beings. And we'll get back to that in a second. So let's dive in. Now that we have this understanding of trust, to really lean on, to rely on, to have confidence in, I am asking now, because Israel chose not to, that the first thing we see is do not trust in the Lord and do not lean on his understanding, but lean on your own. So the situation goes like this. Samuel finds himself, he's older. And boy, I don't know if you've ever started a meeting like this, but the leaders, the elders of Israel all come together. So all the representatives come together and they come before the king and they see what sort of has been happening. First, the elders, I don't know if you tell your boss this ever, that you should start with this anyway, but the way they start is, Samuel, you're getting old, which means you are not able to do the things you used to do. And what we've noticed is that you placed your sons in charge. And normally that would probably be okay, but what was wrong with his two sons? Well, they were to judge the nation, and they liked bribes. They were greedy. They liked money. And so what do we have in verses 1 through 5? We have this idea that the elders don't like the idea that Israel is going to be led in a dishonest way. That's a really good thing, right? They are watching out for their people. But the elders, as they start asking and thinking and mulling over and meeting and deciding for their welfare and the future of their welfare, some more things start creeping into their mindset. So when the elders come together, they decide that they want honesty. But they also, I think, looking in their past, want something more stable, something that they can have control over, something mechanistic. What do I mean by that? I simply mean a system or a process that would produce quantifiable and controllable results. Isn't that what we look for most of the time in our life? Is a situation where we can control or at least know what's going to happen when it comes to things that can be quantified and our results. Well, in their mind, a king with an heir like the other nations would fit this bill really well. So if we go back into the law in Deuteronomy, we find something that's very important to this passage, and it's this, that their request was not wrong. It was not wrong for them to ask for a king. Let me quote just a few verses from Deuteronomy 17, and it says this. If nothing else, the Lord knew this was coming. I think he even had it planned. When you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. And then it goes on, verse after verse, just saying what the king should look like, how he should act. But notice that a king wasn't, the idea of asking for a king wasn't necessarily wrong. So, of course, then my mind thinks of a question, and maybe yours immediately thinks of a question. Then what's wrong with this passage? Why is it wrong for them to ask for a king? It's simple, I think. It's literally misplaced trust. It's not a matter of if you will trust, but what or who will you trust? I think the point is self-evident. This is a self-evident truth. You know what a self-evident truth is, right? Something that doesn't necessarily need demonstrating, something that just intuitively we all know to be true. You and I are contingent beings. We are dependent. We must rely on something outside of ourselves for absolutely everything in life. I had fun thinking this week of just naming one thing that we are not dependent on. And as I was sitting there thinking, even breathing, I'm thinking to myself, I don't even have control over this. My breath could stop with the next one. My heart instantly could stop with this next beat. I don't have control. We don't have control over any of it. Therefore, we must put our trust in something. And in this specific moment, Israel chooses to put their trust in someone or something rather than the all-knowing, all-powerful, all-loving God, who happens to have up to this point an impeccable track record. And so, as we think about this idea of not trusting in God, but trusting in ourselves, and the way that we go about it, can I ask you a question? What are those good things in your life? Those things that are not sin, those things that you are called to do, those things in life that are good. Maybe one of them happens to be raising your kids well. Maybe one of those things, young people, single people, is finding a spouse. Is there anything wrong in that? No. Is there anything wrong in wanting to raise your kids well? No. What about taking care of your family? Is there anything wrong with having a good job so that you can pay your bills? What about this church and ministry opportunities? Is there anything wrong with doing ministry within the church or even in the community? No, I don't think so. But what happens when we take all of those good things and we decide to misplace our trust with those things so that whatever those things are, maybe something I named or maybe something that you have in your life specifically, you need control over it to the point that instead of trusting God, what you've done is you've taken that good thing on and now you are controlling it so that hopefully you can have quantifiable and controllable results. Well, if we continue on, we come to the next part of the proverb, and it says, do not acknowledge the Lord. And this goes hand in hand with not trusting him. The people we find reject the Lord in 6-9. Here we have, Samuel takes this personally. Samuel doesn't like to hear this. He's given everything to these people. He has, I think, fulfilled his calling, boy, to the T. And so these elders come and they hear this, Samuel, they don't say that Samuel's done a bad job, right? Maybe in raising his kids. They don't follow after the Lord. There's some struggle there. We could talk about that. That could be an argument. But Samuel's done everything fine. And the people don't necessarily go after him. But what they are doing is, in a sense, going after the office. And they're saying, you, as a judge, and the judges that came before, this isn't working for us. We don't like this. We need something more stable. We want a king. And you can see Samuel almost sitting back and crossing his arms and going, what? What are you talking about? This has worked fine. And really taking it personal. And the judge, well, don't take it personally. This is nothing personal. This is just business. So then what does Samuel do? Like a good judge, like a good priest and prophet, he goes to God and, God, what's going on? Your people are causing problems again. And what does God tell him? Samuel, you're in a long line of guys. This has happened over and over and over again. But here's the thing, they're not really rejecting you, they're rejecting me. In fact, Jesus has told this to the disciples. You will be rejected because of me. Samuel, I guess, takes it okay. I can't imagine that he took this really well. I still feel like through the rest of this chapter, there's sort of tough love and maybe a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. I might be reading into that a little bit. But I think that's kind of what he's feeling. But God explains here what this rejection looks like. Again, it is this idea that the people choose to trust in their own knowledge, their own wisdom, their own actions. They reject God. Rejecting God is not acknowledging God. In fact, to reject is the idea of forgetting, to disregard, to pay no attention to. So husbands, when you live through a day and you have forgotten your wife, technically what you are doing is rejecting her. They know that. And they ask why. And a lot of times, guys were not smart enough to put those two things together. And here, Israel was not smart enough to put this together. They didn't quite understand that if they just kind of forgot for a second, that that would actually be rejecting. But that is exactly what God is saying. They have forgotten me, and therefore they are rejecting me. They're saying no. But here's the thing. If we're to be real with ourselves, often it's really hard to trust in a God that you cannot see face to face, isn't it? A God that does not come through for you or for me in contractual ways. We can't control him. I don't know about you, if you've ever even tried, maybe just in prayer, to kind of bind God in some kind of contract. It doesn't work. You don't say, if this, then this, to God. Sometimes it's hard to trust in a God that we cannot control. Though often his track record, again, seems to be pretty good. And here in these verses, it's really interesting because notice when he talks to Samuel, you know what excuse he uses? Or I don't know if it's an excuse, but he just kind of like brings this up very sort of, kind of in a nice way. He goes, Samuel, listen, they're not even trusting the God who saved them from Egypt out of slavery. It was like enough for them to trust me to get them out of that place. But then after that, no, it's been headache after headache. They just don't trust with the small things. The underlying premise we all have, and we like Israel, is that it's safer. It's better if we trust ourselves and do it ourselves. We're great at putting together a pros and cons list, aren't we? We're great at analytical thinking. Reasoning out the problems, reasoning through our solutions, seeing the problem from every angle and taking forever to make a decision on it. Here's the problem. This comes from a theologian I was looking at this week. But listen to this sentence. The problem with this is that our proposals and solutions then can be completely reasonable, clearly logical, obviously plausible, and utterly godless. Let me say that again. The problem with our own decision-making when we try to do it all by ourselves is that we can be completely reasonable, clearly logical, obviously plausible, and still utterly godless. Israel trusting in themselves, choosing to steer the ship, leaves God in the dust. How often we do this? And we do this, I think, in one of two ways. The first is unconsciously, which isn't a good thing either. It's the simple question, how many days, how many times have you gone through a full morning, a full afternoon, or you have woken up and gone to bed and not really spent any time thinking about your Maker? The decisions are so urgent. Life is so in the moment and in the now that, oh yeah, God. Sorry, I just needed today to get things in order. There were too many situations. Things were too urgent. Tomorrow will be better, and I will find you again. We'll talk. Just later. That's the unconscious. I don't know which of these is worse, that or the conscious method where we actually think that God is a co-pilot somehow, that God is there, just hang off a bit and let me just handle things. And when then I have trouble, oh, please, may your promises just flood my life. May you come through with me with your love and grace and mercy. Here's one of the issues that I really want you to understand this morning that I think is very pertinent in this chapter. Trust as dependent beings is a major part of worship. In fact, I would almost go as far to say that trust and worship are two sides of the exact same coin. The thing or person you trust most is where you will direct your worship. There is a direct correlation between these two things. The more you trust God in your everyday decision-making, everything you do, the more you trust God, the more you will worship him. The more you trust money and power and fame and everything else that comes with it, the more you trust other things, the more you will worship those things. Rejecting God, not trusting God, leads us right back to idol worship. We are found again, just like Israel, bowing our knee to something else other than God. Why? Because we trust that other thing more than God. So now we come to the third part of the passage, and it says, your paths will not be straight, or your paths will be crooked if you choose to trust in yourself, if you rely on your own understanding, if you leave God out of it, your paths will be an absolute mess. And we see this in 10 to 18. And so what happens in 10 to 18 in the story is kind of interesting. Isn't it a weird twist that God says to Samuel after he hears all this, give him what they want. It's okay, give him a king. Exactly what they're asking for, give it to him. Just do me a favor, warn them first about this. Boy, just the whole fatherly thing swept over me like crazy. I love, in a sense, the twist of saying yes to my kids, almost trying to call my bluff. And so then what I do is I rattle off all these arguments of why this would be terrible and why you shouldn't. And with smiles, they go, okay, we're going to go do it now. It's like, come on, are you serious? And if it's sugar like a Slurpee, I say, get me one too. Which actually just sort of happened the other day. What God does is he warns Israel. And here's the warning. You're going to have a king rule over you like the other kings, and then guess what the king is going to do? In contractual ways, the way you want, he may come through for you. But there is a word that is listed at least 5 times in this passage, depending on how you translate words, but the same word for take is used here. And then there are other parts of the passage where you could say that it's the same idea. So now you're getting up into 11, 12 times. What the king will do is the king that rules like the other nations will take from you. They will take, he will take this, and he will take this, and he will take this, and he will take this. And at the end of all of it, he will leave you wanting. And so what does this path look like then? When we reject God by placing our trust in ourselves, we are choosing the path of the world. There is no, I will do it my way. I'm sorry, Sinatra, but it doesn't work that way. And listen, I hear this often. I'm sorry, but this is a major argument I hear, especially from confessing believers. I don't need the church. I don't need this or that. I can do it my way. That is the way of the world. There are 2 paths we can be on. We can be on the way, the path that God has laid before us, or everything else, which is simply the other path, which is the way of the world. There is no third way. And we find that if you choose the path of the world, it leads to a world of hurt. And the question is why? And the quick answer is simply this: because you cannot be opposed to God and win. Did you hear that? No matter how small the detail, you cannot be opposed to the God who creates you, created you, and sustains you, and think you can win. It does not work. But the deeper answer is that the kings of this world that we trust in, other than the living God, do nothing but take. Everything else that you put your trust in, the job, it will only take. When initially you do it again for good measure and good reasons, and it's all laid out before you, but you take all that trust, and then the 40 hours turns into 50 hours and turns into 60 hours, and before you know it, the job is taking more and more of you, and now you're no longer a father, and you're no longer a husband, and you're no longer an elder, and you're no longer even seen in church. Your God takes and takes and takes and takes. And we see this in relationships, if that happens to be your king. We see it in religion, if that happens to be your king. And everywhere else, if it is not the living God. And what ultimately it will lead to is what God says to Samuel is that the king you have chosen will lead you to cry out. And what he means here is in pain and suffering because you have destroyed your life. Israel's decision will leave them in ruins. It will not work out the way they think. God, though, is the opposite of this. God is the opposite. He takes nothing. Do you know why? Because he needs nothing. The living God takes nothing because he needs nothing. Instead, he gives and gives and gives out of an infinitely generous heart, a heart that is motivated by love. And that love in his giving sometimes is tough love, isn't it? The way this passage goes is there's a twist, and what is the twist? What is God's answer for something that he knows won't work out, at least the way the people want it? Give it to him. He gives the people what they think they want. And we know this all too well, don't we? I know I do in my own life. Sometimes God gives us what we think we want to teach us that it is unfulfilling, that we should not put our trust in it, that it is not something that is satisfying. Instead, it is hollow and misplaced. And ultimately, these things will lead us back into slavery. But one of the things that's so beautiful about our God that I think we miss sometimes is we think that when we do fall into this sin, we do misplace our trust, that usually God comes to us the way fathers most of the time we do, unfortunately, which is wrong and does not show the love of our Heavenly Father. And that is that we come to our children with a chip on our shoulder, saying, I told you, you should have learned something from me. Instead, he comes graciously. Although, can I just take this idea that God has tough love by giving us what we want sometimes? Can I turn this just a little bit? I think this is sort of interesting because it just shows us just another glimpse, another level of God's love for us. And it goes like this, that God uses what turns evil for our good. And this is how I want to explain this. You know the story well of Jacob's brothers and how they hated him. And so what did they do? Joseph. That was his father. Joseph. What did they do? They sold him into slavery. They wanted to kill him, but they sold him into slavery, and it was just evil after evil after evil. And what does Joseph eventually say to his brothers? You intended this for evil, but God intended it for good. Here's where I think you and I are with this. You and I take what we think is intended for good. It turns out evil, and God still uses it for our good. If that's not love, brothers and sisters, I don't know what is. There is never a chip on God's shoulder. Trust is a really hard thing. And as I was looking through this passage and studying it, one of the things that I do not want to just sort of glaze over is that somehow trust can be this easy. It's hard to trust a spouse that you've lived with for 50 plus years. It is hard to trust the things you know the best. God is not someone that's easy to trust all the time, even though he seems to come through. Trust is a hard thing. Especially in those moments when something tangible like a $100 bill would really help. When running water would help. The Krogers finally have running water. They're not here today. They're probably home playing with it. I mean, what was it, almost 4 weeks that they didn't have it? You learn, right? Oh my goodness. Running water is a pretty big deal. These tangible things, you know, God, I want to trust in you, but you know what I'd rather have today is just a clean bill of health. Just job security for a little while longer. We have the choice this morning, as children of God, to trust him. We can do that, you know. Through the power of the Spirit that he has given us, we can trust God. Or we can choose not to. We know that ultimately, and we're not going to find this out for a couple chapters, but God gives them what they want, and it's a king that does not work very well. His name is Saul. But then, God even sort of says that Saul is after the people's heart, and then you know who he gives, right? David. David is a man after God's own heart. The issue is that David's still a sinner. And he messes up big time and causes still some major heartaches for the nation. So the warning doesn't work, but these kings don't seem to work. Read the Old Testament, they just lead him into exile. But then what we find as we open up the New Testament that the King of Kings come. That Jesus Christ, the one that they are all supposed to model, that they can't seem to model, is the one that we are actually supposed to trust in. And so he takes this verse and he applies it to himself and he actually says, trust in me with all your heart. And do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge me and I will make your paths straight. Let me end with this verse. In Romans 8, it says this, And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. We know that well. We wrestle with it. We want to believe it, and we don't often. But here's the kicker. You need the next few verses in order to even get that verse. And here's the next few verses. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. Guess what? Jesus has your salvation all wrapped up for all eternity, forever. Why is it that we don't seem to struggle so much with trusting God with our eternal souls, and yet we have trouble trusting him today with the smallest, dumbest, little things that will pass away? Give Christ your trust, whether it comes to the salvation of your soul and him holding on to that for all eternity, or whether it's a decision that you have to make today and you don't know what the future looks like. Give it all to him, and I promise you he will come through. He may not be controllable, but he will come through. He will be faithful. Let's pray.